Continuing education is more essential and more strategically valuable than ever. The old model of front-loaded education is no longer viable. Today's learners need relevant and flexible CE to keep pace.
And we have a free resource to help your learning business provide that kind of high-impact learning. The Strategic CE Playbook introduces a practical framework to help you strategically design and deliver continuing education programs that will succeed in today's complex and competitive market.
The playbook focuses on three essential levers: personalization, portfolio thinking, and performance.
To learn more about the three levers and how to use them effectively, get your copy of the Strategic CE Playbook at leadinglearning.com/strategic-CE. For learning businesses that want to thrive in the evolving lifelong learning market, identifying metatrends and what they might mean in terms of risks and opportunities is crucial. That's why we offer these 10 points for your consideration. I'm Salisa Steele.
I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
The pace of change in learning markets remains brisk, and the pursuit of learning is not just a goal, it's really a necessity in today's world.
In keeping that context of fast-paced change and learning as a necessity in mind, we want to look at the evolving market for lifelong learning in this episode, number 413. And we have 10 points we think are critical for learning businesses that want to prepare well for the future.
So let's dig in. Number one is the turmoil in higher education will create opportunities.
And there is indeed a lot of turmoil these days in higher education. A lot of questions about the short and the long-term value of traditional college degrees. Those are increasingly being called into question. The number of people looking for alternatives is growing.
I think that not just the value of those degrees, but will the schools even be around? I feel like in the news, I'm seeing report after report of campuses closing.
I saw today that they're closing at a rate of one campus per week right now.
Wow.
I'm not sure I can't remember what the source was on that. So it could be one of those apocryphal internet things, but it feels like that probably could be true just based on what we've seen out there.
So schools, colleges, universities are dealing with very existential questions themselves on top of sort of the consumer questioning of the value of the degrees that are coming out of those institutions.
And so, you know, as a result of that, we said this is going to create opportunities. Well, you know, that means certification programs, assessment-based certificate programs, standards-based digital badges, competency-based education. Those are all likely to be areas of significant growth. In fact, we're already seeing significant growth in those areas for learning businesses providing continuing education and professional development.
So essentially, learning businesses can really offer a compelling alternative to those traditional college degrees that tend to cost a lot of money, tend to take a long time to earn, and maybe don't actually provide that return on the investment. And so you have these really attractive array of alternatives to those traditional degrees that learning businesses can really kind of double down on and place a good bet on those being really attractive to learners in the marketplace.
And we've even posed the question before, the way we framed it was, could associations replace college? Really, that's, you know, could any sort of learning business, anybody who's providing these sort of continuing education, professional development, alternative learning experiences, could those replace college? And we asked this kind of rhetorically several years ago, but ended up revisiting it not all that long ago, because it isn't seeming all that rhetorical anymore. I mean, I don't think degree programs are going to disappear. I don't think colleges and universities are going to disappear. There is a lot of value that they still provide. And at least for the time being, the data still says that college degree is worth something like $1 million more in lifetime income for the people who earn them. But a lot of that's based on old data. We're seeing a lot of things shift. And yeah, we're just going to see some new paradigms. And as we said, that turmoil is going to create opportunities.
The second point we have to offer is every learning business is potentially an international organization.
Which is largely a result of, well, what technology has made possible, and then the way that the economies and trade have evolved over recent decades. And, you know, in spite of all of its flaws and the critiques of the United States right now, people globally still consider it as really the gold standard in most instances for educational credentials. So if you are, you know, a U.S.-based organization, we realize not all of our listeners are, but a large percentage of them are, you're in a position now because you're able to reach the world to take your education out globally. And if you do it right, to really be respected as a potentially international provider of education, even if you've typically, you know, been state or regionally or just nationally based before this.
And again, things like certification programs, assessment-based certificate programs, standard-based digital badges, all of those things, along with the related educational experiences that support them, have significant value in those global markets. So again, kind of compared to someone potentially who's outside of the U.S., coming to the U.S. to pursue a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree, if they can remain in their country and complete a certification or get a standards-based digital badge, that can be very attractive. And as you said, Jeff, tech is making this international play much easier. Self-paced e-learning that's incredibly friendly to all time zones, this idea of if the learner can sort of engage in her own time and space. And I think that artificial intelligence is a type of technology that's going to make the move to international even easier, because you'll have tools that can make translation and localization faster and cheaper, allowing you to potentially access markets that aren't even primarily English speaking if your materials are in English primarily.
Right. And we've focused a bit on, you know, U.S. providers, but all of this applies really to no matter where you are in the world, where you're sitting, you can leverage technology as your tool to help you reach that global audience. So we've got that turmoil in higher education creating opportunities. We've got the opportunity for every learning business to potentially be an international business. Those are the first two. And then the third one is that learners and, critically, employers increasingly seek continuous competency, or what we're kind of labeling continuous competency.
And this global learning economy in which we now live really requires that workers continually replenish their skills and knowledge. Jeff, you have this phrase, the other 50 years, which is this idea of once people complete whatever college or higher education degree they might get, there's still a long period of time, on average around 50 years from that point in time until when they might die. And so there's still all those years of work where they need to be upskilling and reskilling and just trying to stay current in order to be able to do their job. And so that creates this need for continuous competency, as you said. So this idea of, like, let's not just kind of have the one-offs, let's really pay attention to learning as a process and not just those events. And let's really figure out how to kind of continuously retool and stay up to date.
Yeah. And, you know, this goes back to the, well, not even so much the turmoil in higher education, but just that higher education model in general, this idea that you go to school, get a degree, and then you're sort of set, you know, in terms of at least the formal learning you need to do for the rest of your life. I mean, that's never really been true. I mean, we've had data for a long time saying the shelf life of the knowledge you get from degrees is low. Plus, we've always known, at least intuitively, that informal learning throughout a career is really critical. And that's starting to get more recognition now. But I mean, it's just definitely the case that if you want to thrive, it's really just no longer optional to keep learning during those other 50 years. It's why terms like upskilling and reskilling have become such buzzwords, why we have so much focus on that these days. That's just not going to go away. And in fact, it's probably going to shift and change quite a bit as we start to figure out, where does human capability and human learning fit in relationship to machine capability and machine learning? So we're going to have to be continually figuring that out. And the learning businesses really exist to serve the people who are trying to navigate those other 50 years and help them with figuring this out. At Tagoras, we partner with professional and trade associations, continuing education units, training firms, and other learning businesses to help them understand market realities and potential, to connect better with existing customers and find new ones, and to make smart investment decisions around product development and portfolio management.
Drawing on our expertise in lifelong learning, market assessment, and strategy formulation, we can help you achieve greater reach, revenue, and impact. Learn more at Tagoras.com/more.
So number three that we just talked about, learners and employers increasingly seek continuous competency. Number four, relationships with subject matter experts are different. And this ties to the fact that SMEs have more opportunities than ever for producing and delivering content on their own. I mean, again, this gets back to tech and what tech has enabled in so many ways, where there are many more tools that make it essentially kind of WYSIWYG approach to designing and developing and creating learning experiences. So subject matter experts don't necessarily need learning businesses as a channel, as a way to get access to learners the way that they did in the past.
Yeah, you can look at companies, sites like Udemy, for example, which are just huge marketplaces for courses now, where any individual expert can go and create a course. It's going to provide them with a channel directly to learners. It's also going to provide them with a business-to-business channel, because Udemy is really, they've got a large corporate presence now as well. So subject matter experts have a lot more options. And then at the same time, learners really are demanding more of subject matter experts, presenters, teachers than they ever have before. And most subject matter experts have never really been trained to be effective teachers. They're usually experts in whatever field, industry, topic area that they specialize in, but that's very different from knowing how to teach people effectively what you know.
And so for us, this points to the need for learning businesses to invest in helping their subject matter experts improve and helping them be excellent in how they deliver not only the content, but how to deliver it effectively so that the learners actually are able to take it away and apply it to their lives and their work. And so I think there's a real focus on the relationship between learning businesses and subject matter experts needing to be more collaborative and really recognizing that the subject matter experts are bringing certain resources and skill sets into the learning business, and then the learning business can help in other ways. Often primarily around this idea of what do we know about learning science? What do we know about andragogy? How can we help make sure that the content that subject matter experts are presenting is delivered effectively?
And we do have an offering to help with that. Many listeners will be aware of our Presenting for Impact training for presenters to help them create more effective presentations for, you know, webinars, online courses, those types of things. That's available for free. You can easily find it on the Leading Learning site. Just look in the navigation there for Presenting for Impact, but we'll also be sure to link to it here in the show notes. I'll throw in one other thing here, and it's occurring to me really probably every one of these points, we can state the point and then probably as a wrap up say, just add AI and see what happens when AI is added. Because AI is also going to change this because, you know, what a human subject matter expert is needed for is going to be different. It already is different, I think, than it was, you know, just 1 or 2 years ago. And in another 1 to 3 or 3 to 5 or 5 to 10 years, that's going to keep changing. So what role do subject matter experts, human subject matter experts, play in learning environments? What does that mean for the SME, for the subject matter expert? What does it mean for the learning business? What does it mean for the learner? And that's territory that learning businesses are going to have to lead the way through.
Well, and there's another aspect there. I thought what you were going to say at first, Jeff, around AI is just also the fact that AI can be used to help your subject matter experts improve their delivery. And we know of one learning business that is leveraging an AI coaching tool to try to help its presenters make better presentations. So, you know, this is taking some of the burden off of the learning business in terms of having, you know, a human resource there to coach the presenter, but they're using an AI tool that can help the presenter become more aware of pauses or stumblings, as I am stumbling here now. So that's another aspect of how AI could help in this relationship between learning businesses and subject matter experts.
Definitely. So that was number four, relationships with SMEs, subject matter experts will be different. Number five is learning businesses need to understand how learning happens.
they do need to understand how learning happens. And it can be easy, perhaps, to focus more on some of the logistics or operational sides of running a learning business, you know, scheduling the courses, planning the conferences, making the e-learning. But learning businesses also need to cultivate a deep knowledge of effective learning principles. The market out there for lifelong learning, professional development, and continuing education really is much more sophisticated. And for most learning businesses that we hear from, it's also much more competitive. And so there's a real need to be excellent, both in terms of the operational logistical pieces, but also in terms of just how to be really effective in terms of helping learners to learn. And I will say, too, that in our experience, most learning businesses need more education staff. They need more of those instructional designers or the programmers or whoever's going to actually be building the things. And they also tend to need a higher caliber of education staff. So there's kind of a quantity and a quality aspect to this. And part of that means that you need to invest in the education talent that you have on staff. One area that may need more attention in at least some learning businesses is investing in in-house subject matter expertise so that you aren't necessarily reliant or wholly reliant on outside subject matter experts to help you develop and deliver your content.
Yeah, and you know, none of this, we should say, is to ding or to diss current education staff. A lot of people end up in those education roles, particularly in organizations like trade and professional associations, kind of accidentally. They may not have really come out of an L&D background, an instructional design background, a learning science background. A lot of people end up coming over from marketing or membership or other roles. People fall into associations by accident in the first place, we know. So yeah, it's a matter of training the staff that are there, bringing them up to speed, but then also, you know, starting to consciously hire in some of those professionally trained, you know, instructional designers and other staff. And as you just said, Salisa, investing in that subject matter expertise. You know, an analogy that we'll use sometimes is what Netflix has done with original programming. Like Netflix used to just like get stuff from every place else and put it out there, much like an education staff might just be gathering presentations from subject matter experts and packaging them into a conference or packaging them into a series of webinars. But then Netflix has moved from there into going into really highly original, award-winning, original, you know, the programming in that home entertainment market, winning, you know, awards for it and everything else. And it's really redefined them as a provider of their particular type of media. I think a lot of learning businesses would benefit from a similar sort of transformation.
And you're right, Jeff, definitely don't want to diss anyone in terms of talking about, perhaps what I said may have made it sound like a current education staff might be lacking. That's not necessarily what I meant, but I think this ties to the third point around learners and employers increasingly seek continuous competency. I mean, mm-hmm. The learning businesses also need to live that out. As a learning business, if you're going to kind of walk the walk, you want to be supporting your education staff in developing new skills, in coming to a deeper understanding of topics like instructional design or learning science. And so just really making sure that you're investing in that and helping them to continuously become more competent in their roles.
Yeah, and so really, I think that point five is kind of around pursuing excellence in both your understanding and your execution of learning and, you know, the facilitation, the creation of learning experiences. But that needs to be paired with our point number six,
which is learning businesses need sales and business development skills. We've already talked about increasing competition, and in that increasingly competitive marketplace, it's difficult for learning businesses to thrive solely with business-to-consumer sales of their products. It's going to make sense for a lot of learning businesses to be able to sell in quantity to other organizations, so into corporations or health systems or governmental agencies. And then as part of doing that, in many instances, learning businesses are going to benefit by being able to deliver customized solutions. So, you know, taking content that they already have, but modifying it a bit to fit that corporate buyer, for example. And then as part of that customization, they'll be able to charge a premium price for that deliverable.
Right. And I think whether you're going for this more business-to-business approach or even with a current business-to-consumer, maybe selling to individual members approach, business development skills can really help you to create and grow partnerships that help you take those further, you know, so better enable you to get into organizations, better enable you to reach audiences beyond what might be in your current database. So really having the skills to find and to develop meaningful partnerships, along with being able to sell, well, both to those partners and to organizations. So all of that is a level of skills in both selling and business development that most learning businesses really don't possess right now. Most learning businesses, in our experience, maybe have marketing skills, because that's really what they've been using, is marketing tools to kind of get the word out and get people to click on e-commerce transactions and things like that. But that's different from really selling, really doing, you know, human-to-human type business development.
And I do think that while business development roles have maybe historically not been particularly prevalent in learning businesses, I do feel like there's kind of a recent-ish focus on business development. I mean, there's a relatively new association, Professionals for Association Revenue, that really is focused on business development and sales in large part. So I do think that there's an understanding that these are important skill sets. And so once you realize the importance, then it's a matter of figuring out how to either hire in those skill sets or cultivate those skills in the staff that you already have.
Yeah, you know, and we're partnered with PAR, the Professionals for Association Revenue, in a number of ways. But we're also seeing this in other parts of the learning business landscape that we're serving commercial firms who are looking more for those larger sales into organizations to leverage their intellectual property, or in the academic continuing education world, much more emphasis now on working with them, with employers, you know, selling into employers, selling into to states and government districts with the educational offerings as much as or more than the historical focus on just enrolling learner by learner, individual by individual.
Our seventh point is demand for demonstrable impact will grow. And I think this is probably a bit of a no-brainer, but there's some factors contributing to this demand for that ability to show that an educational experience is having impact. I think part of one of those factors is our scarcity of time, or we just tend to feel time poor. And so if we're time poor, we really want to make sure whatever time we're going to spend learning is actually going to provide some results. Another aspect is just the fact that there's so many free or very low-cost learning experiences that if you really want a learner to open up their wallet and pay you for an experience, particularly if it's perhaps a premium-priced offering, you really need to make that case about why learning this way is going to benefit them. They want that evidence that there's some real value in that time and money that they're going to spend with you.
Yeah, you know, and our past research and our ongoing work with clients suggests that most learning businesses really aren't measuring educational impact to any significant degree with consistency. So not doing follow-on assessments of any type to determine whether the learning has been retained, whether it is being applied, or even outside of that hard data, just consistently collecting testimonial statements from learners saying that they got the educational value out of it, that it has made a difference in their job or their career or those sorts of things. There are many ways to get the evidence of impact out there, and it really needs to be built into the standard practices of every learning business to do that.
Yeah, it can be numbers-based. It can be more of the softer approach around the testimonials that you mentioned, Jeff. You can also kind of somewhat combine the two with something like the Brinkerhoff success case method, mm-hmm. where you take a little bit more of a buttoned-up approach around, in some ways, kind of just really blowing up and going deep on sort of a testimonial from someone who really did experience impact. You're really looking at why was it impactful. And so there are ways to do that, as you said, and ways all along from hard to easy, from numbers-driven to much more story-based. I think that the medical field may be offering some examples that could potentially be leveraged in other areas. You know, they've been focused in the medical field on things like quality improvement and performance improvement for a long time. And so, you know, kind of looking at what they're doing there might give you ideas, even if your learning business isn't in the medical field.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be a lot more data in general in medical and health more broadly, but particularly medical. I think it's worth following, paying attention to the work of someone like Dr. Brian McGowan, who's been on the podcast many times, who's very focused on getting that sort of good analytical data out of learning experiences and certainly being able to show that the impact has been achieved.
Yeah, Brian is a great resource. We'll make sure to link to at least the most recent podcast conversation that we had with him in these show notes.
So that was number 7 around needing to address that demand for demonstrable impact. It is out there. Again, our survey data, our discussions with employers and learners show that it is indeed out there. Number 8 is that knowledge management and learning are essentially merging.
Yeah, and I think that we've seen evidence of this merging repeatedly in consulting engagements. And I think that as part of a deeper understanding of learning that we have now and how learning really happens and how we can support it, organizations really want to empower individuals not just to participate in formal education experiences, but also to be able to do some of that just-in-time, point-of-need kinds of things. So like just even being able to find documents or discussions or videos that are going to help them answer a targeted question and doing that at the point that they really need it, that's huge. So that's kind of, you know, on the knowledge management side, it's just whatever resources the organization has, being able to tap into those efficiently at the point of need. And that can also then go along with the more formal education. But I think folks are recognizing that formal education, those courses, contained courses, for example, that's not sufficient.
Yeah, and we make this point because traditionally, particularly in larger organizations, knowledge management has been seen as kind of a silo of its own. Basically, all of that management of different content objects, documents, videos, all of that sort of thing, different software to deal with that. You have things like SharePoint, which are related really to knowledge management. But what we're saying is it's an artificial separation, basically, in both the learning and the design of learning and the management of knowledge and really the design of knowledge experiences. Those need to be really become of a piece as we go forward.
And again, this is the place where we add AI to this point.
Yeah, just add AI.
And, you know, you can imagine with custom GPTs that are, you know, built off of an organization's internal resources, that being able to support learners at that point of need is going to probably become easier and easier. And it's a role then that something like a ChatGPT, but built custom for an organization, may be able to really play a significant role going forward.
Definitely. So that's number 8, knowledge management and learning merging. And this really is kind of related, I think. Number 9, blurring and blending will define the user experience.
Right. So with that knowledge management and learning we were just talking about, you already are tying together different types of platforms than what you might just think of as, you know, quote, a learning platform.
And different mindsets, really.
And different mindsets as well. You can layer on top of that the ubiquity of cell phones. We have social media where we can learn things. We have chatbots and these custom GPTs now. And so all of that is really leading to always on learning, that really you can kind of learn at any point in time and anywhere. And so all of this is just really blurring those lines. You know, we have things like flipped learning that we talked a lot about, you know, in the past decades, you know, and I don't necessarily hear that term so much anymore, but, you know, flipped learning really is about kind of blurring the lines between the classroom and what you might do through technology prior to ever showing up in the classroom. And so what all this really points to is that a learning business needs to have a plan for connecting with learners where they are, and where they are is many places. And so you really got to be aware of all those places where learners might be needing help learning from you. And so try to figure out how can you be there.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, my own activities as a learner and sort of how I do things. And I'm always flowing between, you know, I've got things I'm typing into Evernote, which I'll do on the laptop, but then I'll also do on the phone. And then I'm accessing Feedly for my RSS feeds. And of course, then there's whatever's going on in email. And I may watch this video and learn something. And then of course, go back to Evernote and put something in Evernote about it, or bookmark something in Feedly as a result of it. And it's a flow, really. And I think helping learners to navigate that flow is important. I think increasingly curation is very important, because there is just so much out there. And anybody who can sort of help me get to that next resource much more efficiently, effectively, and then use it in a meaningful way is going to be very valuable to me as I am going through this sort of blended and blurry learning experience.
Well, and we did say blended, and that points to this idea of online and offline. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that changed or shifted with COVID, and it became much more common to have those blended approaches. And now, as we're post-pandemic, there's still a little bit of a shaking out to happen in terms of kind of the right balance. But I think there's a new found appreciation for what can be done in person and what can be done online. So if you're going to gather in person, make sure to make it meaningful and valuable, that it was worth the time for people to come together, and then make use of technology to help people prepare for or follow up after those meetings. And so we're in this state of still kind of trying to shake out what that right balance is, what it looks like. But all of that, again, points to this blurring and blending. And I think things are going to only get blurrier and blendier as we move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, you know, if you're designing a face-to-face experience of any sort, and you're not building into that process, like as a standard practice now, let's think about which parts of this could actually be done online, on a phone, whatever, without having to show up at this event. What would support it before? What would support it after? What would help to improve the actual face-to-face experience? You have to be thinking of that now when you design. And I think the flip side is probably true too. As you focus more and more on designing online experiences, asking yourself, at what point would it make sense for whoever we have engaged online to actually come together face to face in some sort of meaningful way? Because you're probably going to find some great new face to face opportunities in thinking that way about the learning experiences.
We are now at number 10.
The
last of the points that we brought to the table today. And this is, risk is more essential than ever.
And so we needed to throw an acronym in here at the end just for good measure. So the risk we're talking about is not your typical R-I-S-K risk. It is R-I-S-C. And that stands for rapid intelligence with strategic confidence. And we think that's going to become increasingly critical. Let's talk a little bit about what we mean by that.
Yeah, so I think that what we've seen is that the folks who really knock it out of the park are learning businesses who are able to detect market trends and see those early and then respond in strategic ways. And so if you can kind of see what's coming or what's kind of right around the horizon, and then position yourself to have the resource that's going to help someone as that sort of trend crests, then you're going to really set yourself up for success. You're going to be providing those learners with important content and resources, and it's going to then bring in that important revenue for your learning business.
And this is really the idea of foresight that we've talked with Jeff DeCagna about. Is that going to come out before or after this episode?
It's going to come out after this episode.
It's going to come out after this episode. So you'll have to look to the future to have some foresight into finding out what Jeff DeCagna is saying about foresight, though you can easily find that by just typing in Jeff DeCagna and foresight. But really this idea of learning with the future. So you're doing the work to track what's going on out there in the market, and you're using that to inform you and give you some confidence around making some strategic decisions, some things that you're going to pilot, some things that you're going to try. When we're talking about monitoring the market, we're not talking about rocket science here. It's things like your analytics from social media and from email. It's getting feedback from running surveys with SurveyMonkey or whatever it is. It's, you know, really tuning into those member and customer conversations that you're seeing in discussion forums or in social media and other places. You know, just taking advantage of all these sort of agile market research methods that are now available to us as businesses of any type.
Right. And the risk that rapid intelligence with strategic confidence has to do with, yes, you need to be listening and you need to be understanding what are the trends, what's being talked about, what are the opportunities. But then, of course, you have to translate that into action, as you said, figure out what is it you want to pilot or try out and put out into the market and see how it responds. I will say that essentially what we're doing with these 10 points that we brought to the table, I mean, that's part of this detecting market trends. These are 10 things that we think really are shaping the market of lifelong learning. So it's the kind of thing of like tuning into these and then thinking about what does this mean for my learning business? What does this mean for what's in our portfolio? What does it mean for what we might need to add to our portfolio?
Yeah. And, you know, we're trying to really to practice what we preach because this is the kind of approach that's represented in our market insight matrix, for example, which is a tool that we regularly recommend organizations to use as a way to basically put a framework around that rapid intelligence gathering and testing that goes with it. So it's a good companion to this whole idea of risk.
Now, a little bit of a reveal here at the end, Jeff. We actually first wrote about these 10 points some time ago. I'm not actually sure how long ago, but it was on the Tagoras blog back when Tagoras had a blog before Leading Learning even existed. I do know it was at least pre-2016 because we revised these points a little bit in 2016.
Yeah, so it has been quite a while and these same points remain relevant, basically, which, I mean, you could take as maybe we're not making much progress against them, but I think probably what's more likely is that these are persistent and perennial right now. They characterize the age that we're sort of living and working through. At some point, we'll have to sunset some of them, but it feels like they've all been kind of highlighted by the changes that we've seen in technology and that we continue to see with things like AI coming along. The changes we've seen in our understanding of learning science and what works there, just the shift in the nature of work and employment and kind of the global economy in general. I mean, those are all things that we're building coming into the 21st century and are continuing right now. And we're still trying to work our way through them as learning businesses.
So these are our 10 points. As a reflection question, we encourage you to think about what would you add or what might you change in that list? This is a great question for you to consider on your own or with your team if you have one, or pick up the phone and call a colleague or meet for a coffee to discuss.
Maybe we should tick off the list real quick so that the people can think about it. So one was the turmoil in higher education will create opportunities. Two, every learning business is potentially an international organization. Three, learners and employers increasingly seek continuous competency. Four, relationships with SMEs will be different. Five, learning businesses need to understand how learning happens.
Six, learning businesses need sales and business development skills. Seven, demand for demonstrable impact will grow. Eight, knowledge management and learning are merging. Nine, blurring and blending define the user experience. And 10, risk, RISC, is more essential than ever. For learning businesses that want to thrive in the evolving lifelong learning market, identifying megatrends and what they might mean in terms of risks and opportunities is crucial. That's why we offer these 10 points for your consideration.
At leadinglearning.com/episode413, you'll find show notes, a transcript, and options for subscribing to the podcast. If you haven't yet, please do take a minute to subscribe.
We'd be grateful if you would take a moment to rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, especially if you enjoy the show. Jeff and I personally appreciate those reviews and ratings, and they help the podcast show up when others search for content on leading a learning business.
And please spread the word about Leading Learning. You can do that in a one-on-one exchange with a colleague, or you can do it through social media. In the show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode413, you'll find a link to connect with us on LinkedIn.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.